Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. It is indeed an emergency edition of the pod as the captain's picks for the U.S. and International President's Cup teams have just been made. Rex, we'll start for our purposes with the American side, the winners of this event every time since 1998. U.S. captain Jim Furyk is going with Sam Burns, Tony Finau, Russell Henley, Keegan Bradley, Brian Harman, and Max Homa. If you're keeping score at home, that is numbers 7 through 12 of the point standings, as well as numbers 1 through 12 on the list of the available Americans via the official World Golf Ranking. You just got off a teleconference with Captain Furyk. What was the mood on the call?
Twofold. One, I want to start. It's been a long time since I woke up and was excited because pick season is about as close as we get to being able to play reporters for the NFL or the NBA, where the transaction can be such a entertaining story and people pay attention to it. This is like the only time we really get to do this. I guess when he does his pairings in a couple of weeks for the matches themselves, I guess we get a little bit. But pick season is the absolute best. That being said, the one stat that I looked up first thing this morning is the average ranking for the American team, that's 1 through 12 now, is about 12th. It's 11.75. The average ranking for the 12 international players is 35th. So just to be clear, this is not
that happens. That happens every time.
Every single time. And this is not a fair fight on paper. And I looked it up. Minwoo Lee was not alive the last time the internationals won this match. So I'm just trying to put all this in historical context before I launch into some sort of ridiculous analysis of specifically Jim Furyk's picks. Because going 7 through 12, and I think you and I had the exact same reaction. You can't lean into the eye roll emoji enough with him picking 7 through 12. And maybe those are the exact six players he wanted, and that's just happened to be how they fell. And however the magic turned out, 7 through 12 never entered his mind. And he did mention that on the conference call just now, that wasn't sort of – he wasn't trying to play it safe based on what he had done as a vice captain before, based on what he had done as a Ryder Cup captain. This is just the way it played out. And we can sit and pick apart really all of the picks, and I think some of them are –
oh,
really
we are going to.
Sam Burns, pretty straightforward. No one's going to criticize that one. Tony Finau, really straightforward. No one's going to criticize that one. You can keep going down. It seems to me that Jim, and I had so many high hopes for him going into the Ryder Cup in Paris, because I felt like he was going to be kind of the anti-establishment guy. We had had a couple years of what a lot of people refer to as the buddy system when it comes to captains on the American side. I felt like Furyk was going to do what he felt was right, whether if he hurt feelings or ruffled some feathers or did whatever he had to do to make sure. And in retrospect, he was the anti-analytics guy, because anybody that looks at those four captains picks, he had four captains picks going into Paris. It was Bryson DeChambeau, Phil Mickelson, Tiger Woods, and Tony Finau. That group combined went 2-10-0 that week. And the only two, Tony Finau. The rest of them were blanked. Didn't get any points. Didn't get any half points. They would have been better off having the vice captains, who I think was Zach Johnson, Matt Kuchar, and then Jim Furyk. Yeah, and Stricker, play that particular golf course. Now, by all accounts, and I spoke with Jim last week at the Tour Championship about this, he expects kind of the same thing at Royal Montreal. He said it's going to be narrow fairways. It's going to be thick rough. How you can pick Max Homa based on that knowledge? How you can pick Max Homa based on the idea of what happened in Paris? He talks about the lessons that he learned from Paris. Apparently, he didn't learn the lesson that if you're not driving the ball well to finish the season, you're probably not going to find it in that 3 weeks between the end of the season and when they have to show up at Royal Montreal. To put it in context, in Max Homa's last two events, which would have been the BMW and the St. Jude, at St. Jude, he finished 70th in the field in strokes gained off the tee, 70 players in that field. At the BMW, he finished 48th in that category. Only 48 players finished that event. You get the idea. His driving is really, really bad. So the idea that he's going to find the magical elixir between now and the time they get to Montreal, based on what we saw a few years ago going into Paris and what we knew that golf course was going to be like, that to me is ridiculous.
Take a breath. That was the most passionate, inspired diatribe you've ever had in like the eight or 9 years that we've been doing this podcast. I mean, was Jim Furyk under attack on the teleconference with reporters? He seemed to bristle at some of this. Yeah, he seemed to, when he was doing the interview with Golf Today, and I just appeared to sort of break down the picks on that show as well. He seemed to bristle at the suggestion that he was playing it safe. He seemed to bristle at the suggestion that Justin Thomas should have been on this team. He seemed to bristle at the suggestion that Max Homa, despite his current form, was a deserved pick as well. What was sort of Jim Furyk's message that he was trying to portray when he was announcing these picks on the teleconference with reporters, Rex?
Well, the first question, and it was from a reporter from Golf Digest, who I won't name, but the first question is, you had to defend the pick of not picking JT 2 years ago, or I'm sorry, last year for the Ryder Cup. And now I'm asking you to defend not picking him for the President's Cup, which is a weird sort of twisted way of saying that he really should have ended up being on that team. I think yesterday you picked him. I think in when I wrote Sunday night when I was leaving East Lake, I felt like JT finished in the playoffs strong enough. I felt like he and Russell Henley had done a very, very good job of giving Jim Furyk something to think about. I get why he probably didn't want to go in that direction. He sort of dismissed the idea that
I cannot fathom why he would not want to go in that direction.
Well, twofold, really. One, based on the idea, and look, he dismissed this, but there has to be something to it. It is a built-in partnership between he and Jordan Spieth. And the idea that Jordan Spieth is not going to be on that team, he just had surgery, we don't know when he's going to come back. That's part of it. I think you don't have that sort of that built-in pairing. However, I feel
Justin
like
Justin Thomas, a generational talent.
I feel like JT is a plug-and-play.
Can play with other players.
Yes, I agree.
Other guys.
I feel like he's a plug-and-play player. And the other half of it is, you have to look at statistically what he was trying to do with that team. I don't think he used statistics or analytics very much at all. He talked a lot about just having gut feeling. So did Mike Weir with his picks, and we're going to get to those. We're just not going to spend this whole podcast picking on Jim Furyk. I'm with you. We could have gone a lot of different directions. I know you had made an impassioned ploy for Nick Dunlap. I don't think that was ever going to be in the cards. The only one that I really get hung up on, and look, you were also kind of sour on Keegan Bradley, kind of based on the idea of one event at Elevation seemed to push him over the top. Just a few weeks ago, he clearly was not in the mix to be a pick. He was a vice captain, so it seems odd that you're going to be in the mix at that point. I kind of get where he's coming from when you look at the idea of the way he's performed in the past, how he fits in to this team. He didn't finish well in the playoffs, but again, we're doing this transit of property thing where, okay, how you played at East Lake is how you're going to play at Royal Montreal. That's not particularly fair or correct. We all know that. But I'm with you. How do you leave JT off the team, and how do you put Max Homa on the team? And I don't want this to sound like I'm piling on to Max Homa. And the one thing that he did say about Max that I did scribble into my notes is he just talked about him being the emotional leader of the team. That I think he was asked on Golf Today right before you were on by Eamon, is this a popular pick? And he was really quick to say, no, this is not a popularity contest, but he is the emotional leader of the team. We saw it at Quail Hollow when he sort of gets in that mindset and he's out there fist pumping and screaming at the top of his lungs. That gets the other guys fired up. I understand all of that, but what you're looking at here is just the facts. You've put a guy in a position. I'm actually shocked that Max would even want to go do this, because the body language the last 2 weeks of the season that he played was, I don't want to see a golf club for a couple of months, not weeks, a couple of months. However, now you're going to put him in a position of being the most pressure he probably faced all year long. And you're demanding one thing out of his game that he has not had this season, which is his driver. And you're going to just plop him down and say, good luck. You can't play him an alternate shot. So your only chance here is to play him in four ball, which I don't even know if that's a good idea.
It certainly is not a good idea. I wonder if Netflix's cameras were rolling when Keegan Bradley got the call that he was going to be on the team, as opposed to being spurned last year, while Justin Thomas, who got the positive call last year, got the negative call this year. 30,000 feet view of this, Rex, is that Jim Furyk was certainly not adventurous with his picks. 7 through 12 of the points list, 1 through 12 OWGR. I think the most head-scratching part of this is it isn't even just the recent form of the players that he did pick. I think it also has to do with who the other available options were that Jim Furyk could have rounded out the American team with, and yet he decided against it. Let's stick with Keegan Bradley here for a second. Yes, he does have the recent win at Elevation, the 50-man event at the BMW Championship, and Damon and Eamon sort of pushed back like, whoa, that's a pretty big result that he had just a couple of weeks ago. The point is that was an outlier. That was an anomaly. The win at the BMW Championship was his only top 20 finish in his past 9 starts. The only reason he got into the BMW Championship field as the last man in at number 50 was because Tom Kim collapsed over the last couple holes at TPC Southwind. Otherwise, Keegan Bradley would have been watching from home. He was 18th in points. He would have been passed over. He would have been at Royal Montreal, not with his clubs, but instead with a walkie-talkie. That's Keegan Bradley. In his place, I would have put a player like Billy Horschel, because when Jim Furyk is citing Keegan Bradley's most positive attributes, it's the grit, it's the passion, it's the determination. Keep in mind, he has not played in a U.S. team competition in a decade. You're already getting those sort of assets and attributes from Keegan Bradley because he's going to be part of the U.S. team room. I would have taken Billy Horschel, who does the exact same thing as Keegan Bradley. He has played consistently better than Keegan Bradley over the past couple months. Remember the deep run at the Open Championship that he had, as well as a couple good finishes in the playoffs. And he is a better putter at this stage of his career than Keegan Bradley is. That is sort of the one-for-one replacement that Jim Furyk overlooked. You mentioned Max Homa. And although he has gone 7-1-2 in the last two U.S. team competitions, although he has been the best American player, you mentioned the struggle statistically, particularly off the tee, just one top 10 finish since the Masters. I would have gone one-for-one replacement with Justin Thomas. What are some of the traits and attributes that Jim Furyk has mentioned about Max Homa? He's the glue guy. He can partner with a lot of guys. He's great in the team room. The guys really like him. He's a fiery presence. He's an emotional leader. Who does that sound like? For the last decade, we've been saying those exact same things about Justin Thomas. And yet what Justin Thomas has done this season that Max Homa has not is play better golf. Five top 10 finishes. That's more than Max Homa, Brian Harman, and Keegan Bradley. He's played well in the signature events. He's played well in a major championship. I don't understand it, Rex. When you look at the career record of Justin Thomas in match play, it smashes Max Homa's level of experience. And you don't have to have the question mark of, hey, you can only play him in one format because he can't keep the ball on the planet.
This is why we love pick season, because both of us just can't get it out fast enough. I will say, when it comes to Keegan, and you're right, it seems to me those two are interchangeable. I'm talking about JT and Keegan for all of the reasons that Jim pointed out, that he felt like Keegan should be on the team. And he also went to great lengths on Golf Today and when he spoke with reporters afterwards to point out that JT, he really wanted JT on the team. Like, it's clear those two have a very close relationship. With Keegan, I almost felt like, and look, if Jim was sitting here, he would obviously push back on this, but I almost felt like this was a make good for not being on the Ryder Cup team last year. I think of all the things that happened going into Rome, and everyone wanted to point to maybe Lucas Glover should have been one of the picks. Lucas Glover himself told me he felt like Keegan should have been one of the picks because of the way he had performed. And that's a kind of a ridiculous way to think about it, but you have sort of these cycles. And in this particular case, Keegan Bradley probably should have been on that team, but he probably shouldn't be on this team. I keep going back to the idea you and I are going to pick this apart. On paper, this is not going to be a very good competition. So all of these things that we're being critical of, it's going to be in a microcosm. Like, it's not going to be the macro. You're going to have to look at this afterwards, as in the Americans will probably win again. It'll probably be a commanding win again. But how did Max perform? And that's really not what we do when we turn around and we start nitpicking.
But Jim Furyk, like you mentioned, pick season is one of your favorites. Like, fantasy football season is sort of coalescing at this exact same time as well. When you think about fantasy football and the draft you're doing there, you want guys who have sort of a mix on your team of a high floor and a high upside, right? Like a high ceiling. We talk about that all the time. To me, Jim Furyk could have raised the floor of these picks while also dabbling in some of the high upside picks as well. To me, Keegan Bradley is a higher floor guy. To me, Justin Thomas is a higher floor guy. To me, Akshay Bhatia is a higher ceiling guy. Like, you can mix and match those sorts of attributes and assets. And Jim Furyk did not seem well-suited to do so, or particularly eager to do so. I'm also curious, Rex, about this Brian Harman pick. Because Brian Harman, he's a fierce competitor, the bulldog, match play specialist. Like, you can throw any sort of cliche and the folks have. Brian Harman has not played particularly well over the past couple of months. Just one top 10 finish since the runner-up of the Players' Championship. He accrued most of the points that led him to being inside the top 12 in the U.S. President's Cup standings based on his play in 2023, particularly with his win at the Open Championship. I don't feel like this was a particularly egregious pick. And yet I still think it was a mistake to take Brian Harman, not drive the ball as well as he had in 2023. And you can get a similar level of putter in Akshay Bhatia that you can in Brian Harman with, again, a higher ceiling as well.
That's why I keep circling back around to this. Like, we can pick these apart. And I am taken by the idea that Jim clearly did not learn the one lesson that I felt like should have been glaring at Paris. The one lesson that all of us realized that, oh, you didn't pick the right people. Like, regardless of the rest of the players, regardless of the eight players automatically qualified, the four that you put on to help out those qualifiers only hurt your process. Tony Finau being the exception in that group. So I'm taken by what it seems like he didn't learn from Paris, the one thing that we all felt like. But again, I keep going back to, and he was asked this by Eamon, I guess if he's the American captain that breaks the string for the President's Cup team, I guess if he's the one that ends the decades long of suffering for the internationals, we'll have a field day when we circle back around. And I fully expect us to do that. I'm still just having a hard time wrapping my mind around how that's going to happen. Because as much optimism as Adam Scott had on Sunday when I talked to him at East Lake, and he had a surprising amount of optimism when we talked about this, I still don't see how you can change this momentum that seems to go on the American side every single year. I know we've had some close ones in the last few matches, but it doesn't seem like they're close enough to turn the tide. This time might be different, and Mike Weir seems to have a formula. But as much as we're going to nitpick these picks, and I think you're absolutely right on multiple fronts. I think Keegan Bradley could have gone in any direction when it comes to that one. And certainly JT or Patea or Harmon. I'm probably not with you on that one. I think Harmon is exactly what the team needs. I think that's the kind of passion that as a captain you want on your team. But Homa, and I hate to pick on Homa because he's had a bad year and he doesn't need us picking on him. But that one baffles me.
And you mentioned, Rex, like this may be a moot point. Like on paper, it still does not appear to be particularly close. But with the six picks that Jim Furyk made on Tuesday, he may have just committed like some acts of self-sabotage. Like if he picks the wrong players and the Americans lose, he is going to be inundated with criticism. And just a quick housekeeping note, Keegan Bradley will not be necessarily, technically he'll be a playing assistant captain, but Jim Furyk said that he'll essentially be relieved of his assistant duties the week of the tournament, very similar to what Anna Norquist will be doing for the European Solheim Cup team as well. Jim Furyk said that he expects to name a replacement assistant captain for Keegan Bradley here in the next couple of days.
I think there's something to that because he did mention in the conference call with reporters that he could actually name two more assistant captains. So I don't know that Keegan is going to be considered a playing vice captain simply because of that. Like I think Jim wanted the flexibility of, okay, he's not a captain, although he probably will be because you want him involved, getting him ready for next year. I understand all that. I do find it fascinating that when pressed, not only on Golf Today, but in his interview with reporters, he wouldn't even give a hint of who the vice captain would be. And I didn't get the idea it was going to be Tiger Woods. So I will be curious to see who he brings in next.
Yeah, Jim Furyk can have a maximum of five vice captains. Right now, he has just four. Again, Keegan Bradley is, sort of officially stripped of his assistant captain duties. He could have two. Tiger Woods would be a name to be considered. I highly doubt that if he was not able to do the Ryder Cup captaincy in 2025. I have a hard time believing he'd be pressed into emergency duty here. Matt Kuchar is probably a name to watch as well. Any other names, Rex, that you would bandy about as potentially wearing an earpiece for Royal Montreal?
No, and he might just circle back around and name, I don't know, bring in Freddie or whoever. Yes, I mean, someone who's been there before, someone who can help him with the pairings. I think the one thing that when I spoke with Jim last week about it, and again, I'm kind of going back to the idea of what did you learn that went wrong in Paris that you think you'll be able to fix this time around? And he sort of talked about how fast everything goes once the week starts. Like, it seems like the two-year buildup takes forever. But then once the first golf ball goes in the air, it seems like everything moves at just lightning speed. And as a captain, you're having to make so many decisions, important decisions on the fly, specifically as they apply to getting the pairings right for the next session. And in that particular case, I think he would want as many voices and as much information as possible.
That is the U.S. side. On the international side, international captain Mike Weir chose Corey Connors, Minwoo Lee, Taylor Pendrith, Mackenzie Hughes, Siwoo Kim, and Christian Bezuidenhout. I don't gather, Rex, that you feel as strongly or as passionately about the picks that Mike Weir made. Do you think he did a good job? Do you think he did a questionable job? Do you think he did just sort of a shrug, let's see how it plays out sort of job? What's your takeaway from what Mike Weir did?
So this is the opposite of what, you know, we just hashed over when it came to Jim Furyk. It seems like going 7-12 seems like you just mailed in a homework assignment. It's you just checked the box.
I said it was essentially like Jim Furyk was auto drafting. Like he just left an auto draft. He probably forgot the draft was going to be on. He forgot he had to make the picks.
I know.
Live on golf. He's like, oops, sorry. I'm sure those 12 will be fine.
So in Mike Weir's case, I will give him credit that he did drift all the way down to McKenzie Hughes at 15th, that he did pass over some players that you probably would have thought. I thought Cam Davis was going to be on the team, to be quite frank with you. So I will be curious as time goes on how that dynamic played out. I think he wanted as many Canadians on the team as possible. He ended up with 3 Canadians on the team. He could have gone even deeper than that. That might have been a perception issue. Again, he had another conference call with reporters afterwards, and it did sound to me like he was walking a fine line, that you leave Nick Taylor off, and we all know his history at the Canadian Open and what it would mean to the crowds to have him there. You leave Adam Hadwin off. And, of course, another Canadian you would want in that mix. But Mike was really quick to point out that this is an international event, and he had to look at a lot of different players. I like the idea that when he was asked specifically about Mac Hughes in the conference call with reporters, he said a quote-unquote gut feeling. And so, again, it doesn't seem like either captain's leaning in. This is not Moneyball. They're not going to the back room and turning the computers on and having the numbers crunched. And, yep, that's what we're going to do. It seems to me that both captains just did the eyeball test. Like, yep, I like him. Like, well, he's not playing great, and maybe he's not a good fit for the golf course. Yep, it'll be fine. So I am curious, like, when in the weeks after the matches is always when we start finding things out that are more interesting to me, because it's at the time of these picks, or I guess on Sunday night at Eastlake, both captains are clearly huddled with their teams trying to figure out, okay, who are going to be our six. It did not look like either captain cared about the analytics of it all, and that does surprise me.
I do think that there was data that leaned in McKenzie Hughes' favor. Keep in mind, perhaps, he was passed over in 2022, despite being a member at Quail Hollow. That, of course, is a big ballpark. Need to have a masher off the tee. McKenzie Hughes, that is not the strength of his game. Instead, he's one of the best putters and chippers of the golf ball.
Ryan Fox should have been on that team. So to your point, Ryan Fox should have been on that team that went to Quail Hollow. I made that argument very, very strongly. The only reason he wasn't is because he was playing the majority of his golf overseas. I mean, he was a bomber. He clearly was perfect for that team, for that golf course, and didn't feel like he got a sniff.
Yes, I think that's certainly fair. We can go back to rewind the podcast from 2022 to see if you were just as impassioned of a plea with there. Like, I in a nod to our friend Mark Schlabaugh of ESPN, like, I think of these in tiers and in the locks. Like, on the U.S. side, I thought the locks were Sam Burns, Tony Finau, and Russell Henley. On the international side, I thought the locks were going to be Corey Connors, phenomenal ball striker, Canadian, 7th in points, that just missed out. Taylor Pendrith, he won this year at the Byron Nelson. He just made the East Lake for the Tour Championship. I thought Minwoo Lee, tremendous young talent, just 26 years old, can sort of be a spark plug for that team a la Tom Kim in 2022. And Siwoo Kim, I thought, was a lock as well. Top-tier ball striker, can pair well with a hot putter. And so it was really coming down, I thought, in Mike Weir's mind, to just 2 picks. Again, Mac Hughes, to me, is eminently defensible, wants to have as many Canadians as possible. 3 seems to sort of thread the needle of having enough for the home crowd to get behind while not having so many that you're potentially undermining the competitive integrity of the team or even heaping too much pressure on the Canadians as well. And Christian Bezuidenhout, I thought, was a defensible pick as well. The strength of his game is a good putter. Just had his best season to date on the PGA Tour and made the Tour Championship. You mentioned the 2 Canadians, and Nick Taylor and Adam Hadwin. Nick Taylor's not done anything since winning the Phoenix Open in dramatic fashion, essentially played his way out of consideration for this team. Adam Hadwin statistically is not a strong ball striker as well, really across the board compared to Mac Hughes, just didn't quite fare. To me, the biggest snub is Cam Davis here. He played on this team in 2022, had a couple of key moments at Quail Hollow. He won the Rocket Mortgage in July. He was 8th in the point standings. He had a nice finish in the playoffs at the BMW Championship. Statistically, if you're going to say that Mike Weir is not leaning heavily into the data or the analytics here, statistically, Cam Davis was all over the board. Not a strong ball striker, not a strong putter. He did sort of pop up at times and have these occasional flourishes, but from a full body of work, McKenzie Hughes's was better in 2024. I think that's why he leaned in that direction.
Well, and you can kind of go down the list. It will be curious, and I pointed this out on Sunday night when I was writing about the potential picks, that Minwoo Lee was almost a lock to me because of what he and Jason Day did in Paris at the Olympics. That's not a team event, so clearly it doesn't factor into this. But those two really turned it into a team event. They got there early. They were there the Sunday before. They practiced together. They ate together. They stayed in the same hotel. Like, they clearly clicked. And so in Mike's mind, I'm sure it was, oh, this is going to be an easy pairing, because then you're going to start looking at Adam Scott. He's a veteran. Who are you going to put him with? You probably want to put him with a younger player. I agree. He threaded the needle pretty well. If you go back to when the President's Cup was played at Royal Montreal last time around, Mike Weir was the only Canadian there. And you want to get the crowds behind you from the very get-go. You need to turn this into some sort of home field advantage. That's the way to do it. But if you went 4-5 deep, that wasn't going to work.
Rex, speaking of data and analytics, I'll be able to go back and look and see if this is our least listened to or least watched podcast in history. Because I'm curious, Rex, like, is there actually apathy towards this event? Do fans even care about the President's Cup? As I mentioned off the top, the international team has not won the President's Cup since 1998. It has been decidedly one-sided. The international team has been decimated by the live defections. There's been a lot of hankering and calls for this to be sort of blown up and turned into a mixed team event. Can the internationals actually make this a competitive product in 2024, or should this thing be blown up?
It was one of those knuckleballs that we always get from Eamon yesterday when I was on Golf Today. And I think he essentially said, is it irrelevant, which is a bit of a hot potato to throw at someone on the network that is airing this particular tournament. So I'm going to say it's not irrelevant. There is a danger that it is trending in that direction, though, because without parity, you're not going to have anything close to what you end up with at the Ryder Cup, which is, by all accounts, not just one of the greatest events in all of golf. It's one of the greatest events in all of sports. Why? Because they go back and forth, because you have that parity, because it comes down to these exciting finishes on Sunday. You just don't have that at the President's Cup. So, yes, I think you're constantly in danger the further we get away from 1998. And as I pointed out at the beginning of this podcast, there is a member of the international team who was not alive the last time the internationals won this. I can't lean into that enough. It shows you how, look, I don't want to call the international side irrelevant. And I'll go back to what Adam Scott told me on Sunday at Eastlake. I'm always surprised when a veteran like that, who has been, let's just admit it, just beaten down by this event, like, he has done nothing in this event but lose every 2 years, match after match after match. So I'm shocked when he's excited about it, but I keep going back to the idea, how long is that going to last? If you're Adam Scott, how many more times do you want to go through this? How many more times do you want to put yourself through it? I will give Ernie Els a monsoon of credit. He tried to create something when he was captain, that get them to play under one shield, under one flag, is the idea. You have all of these players coming from all these different parts of the world, and it's been difficult for them to get them to sort of cohese as a unit. And that's perfectly understandable. I think Trevor Immelman last time around did a good job of taking that another step forward, trying to get all of these players to believe that they're in a team. I think Mike Weir has taken a good step. I don't know if we're any closer, though, because I'll go back to the stats that I started this podcast with. 11.75 average world ranking for the U.S. team, 35 for the international team. That's not good statistics.
I just noticed, Rex, that I was drinking out of a Southern Soul barbecue cup. Shout out Mackenzie Hughes, former winner of the RSM Classic. That must have been on my mind when I was going into the cabinet. I hear what you're saying. I thought the turning point for this event could have been in 2017 at Liberty National. Remember when the Americans like almost could have closed out the event on Saturday? Yeah. Like, I think that would have been reason to blow this thing up and try again. But in the two editions since then, 2019, they just re-aired it on Golf Channel on Tuesday. Like, the Americans were down heading into Sunday singles, stage a pretty miraculous final day comeback at Royal Montreal, led by playing captain Tiger Woods, and won back the cup that way. In 2022, Quail Hollow, although the eventual margin of victory was 5 points, I remember distinctly being on the back nine, and there was about a 45-minute window where there was actually a pathway for the internationals to win. Again, it looks bad on Wikipedia.
You tried to make it.
There was a 45-minute window where it was actually possible. Again, it did not come to fruition, but it was at least believable at that point. I think Trevor Immelman in the press conference afterwards said, like, we're closer than we've ever been to making this thing a competition. The internationals, the internationals have to be tired. To your point, the internationals have to be tired of being the plucky underdogs who are going up against the dominant Americans and are just trying to give them a spirited run. Like, that is not the spirit of competition. Eventually, you have to win, or it's just a waste of everyone's time. It's a waste of the Americans' time. It's a waste of the international players' time, who are just continually futile in their efforts to win this tournament. And the captains over the past 2 years in particular, Trevor Immelman and Mike Weir, have not been helped out by the organizing body of the President's Cup and the PGA Tour with the live defections and having these teams decimated by live players. Like, this would have looked dramatically different if Joaquin Niemann was on this team, if Cam Smith was on this team, if Dean Burmester was on this team, if Louis Oosthuizen and Abe Anser and Carlos Ortiz are on this team. That would have been a much more even, much more compelling match. Instead, we're sort of robbed of what could be a dramatic competition. Look, we're still going to cover it. We're still going to enjoy it. Like, team golf to me is the best thing that we cover all year long, but it's not as good as it could be. And to that respect, I understand the fan apathy.
Well, and I do want to counter this, and I want to fill in the gaps real quick. I want it to be competitive. Personally, professionally, I want it to be competitive. I work for a network that wants it to be competitive.
Competitive is not good enough, though. Like, well, the internationals have to win, or it's a waste of time.
I would agree with that. Like, we have seen it, it came down in Korea a few years ago, where it did come down to that last match, and it was exciting, and it felt like they had some momentum. But now we're still many, many years removed from those matches, and we still haven't gotten to the finish line. So I am going to agree with you on that front. They need to win one. You want it to be interesting, because you're right. These are the most interesting events that we cover all year long. Go back to Rome last year. You want it just to be close. The blowouts don't work in either direction. If it's Europe winning by a blowout or the United States winning by a blowout, you always want it to be close. It's a more compelling product. It's a more entertaining product. I will see if we're closer, and you make a really good point that when you look at the impact that LIV Golf had on both teams, and I think we had the same conversation going into Rome last year for the Ryder Cup. I made the argument last year that the Europeans were actually impacted more than the United States team. I'm not quite sure if it played out that way. This time around, I think you're right. On the surface, it looks as if the international team, they were robbed of all of these players that would have been sort of the heart and soul of this team that was building in the right direction, and now they're gone. And it's almost as if Trevor 2 years ago and Mike this year has had to start from scratch. You like their team, and I think if you look at the way they're playing, certainly Hideki leading the way. Adam Scott is playing much better. Jason Day actually had a solid finish to the season. So they have some reasons to be optimistic, but I'm still going to believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as dramatic of a makeover as what Trevor Immelman had to do in 2022. Like, remember the live defections throughout the PGA Tour season that year really left him shorthanded. It was basically miraculous. The internationals only lost by five, given the turbulence that they had over those final couple months of qualifying. I think you're spot on with that, Rex. If the internationals are going to win, it's not going to be because of the six captains picks that Mike Weir did and whether or not he was leaning into the data and the analytics. Hideki Matsuyama has to come to play. Adam Scott has to continue to play the way that he has over these FedEx Cup playoffs. Jason Day has to step up and partner with Minwoo Lee in a dramatic way. Tom Kim needs to show his potential, sort of flashback to 2022 as well. We'll be there to cover it in a couple weeks' time. If the action is not compelling, Rex, at least you and I will be eating some of the best steaks of our life at Joe Beef, the reservation in Montreal.
You've already got the itinerary ready, don't you?
Has already been reserved. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys know the drill. For much more on the President's Cup Captain's Picks, go to NBCSports.com/golf. We'll be skipping the Sunday podcast this week because there is no PGA Tour action. We'll be back next week with a season preview in Napa. Forgot what the official title of that PGA Tour fall opener is, as well as sort of a season in review for the 2024 PGA Tour proper. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Pick season.